of the ideology or project of pure art, which presumably has escapist functions in the real world. And the question here is whether there are other projects active in Flaubert, and the even more difficult question, how these various projects relate to the work and play of the text. All uses of language are, of course, coded to some extent, but the relation of any code or set of codes to actual usage may be intricate. And the nature of the interaction of a text with codes or ideological contexts is not a foregone conclusion. Here, instantiation is, I think, a particularly misleading concept, as is the opposition between type and token. Highly stereotypical texts, such as popular romances, commercials, and political propaganda, tend to be highly coded and ideologically saturated because they are premised on the desire to get a delimited message through to the reader. They tend to reproduce and reinforce dominant ideologies and discursive practices. More complex texts, such as significant novels, have a more tangled relation to codes. Yet a compelling consideration is that an ideology or code, especially when it engages deep-seated, even unconscious prejudices or desires, exercises constraint over discourse. And no text, however exceptional, is entirely immune from this process or lucid about its operation. As Louis Althusser has argued, ideology interpolates or addresses the subject. Through politically interested recognition scenes, it plays a role in constituting our pre-critical sense of identity, and it also helps to account for the resistance to certain modes of criticism. And this notion of ideology, which someone like Althusser is trying to rework, is very, very important. One can note, for example, that in a very important historical work, Bernard Bailyn's Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, there is no sense of ideology in this sense. And Bailyn, one has the simple opposition between lying propaganda that consciously deceives on the one hand, and sincere motivation that explains events on the other. It should thus be obvious that a crucial issue in interpretation, for me in many ways the crucial issue, is that of the relationship among symptomatic or ideologically reinforcing, critical, and more transformative tendencies in the way a text or any use of language renders its pertinent context or codes. Some texts are themselves especially significant in the way they come to terms with this issue, and within limits they may serve as a model for the reader who is alert to certain considerations. No level of culture or genre has an absolute privilege in this respect, and most of what I've been saying isn't restricted to the novel. But the novel has been particularly rich in texts in which the relation to ideology is complicated by forcefully critical or even potentially transformative effects. Not only has the novel been a particularly restive genre that has assimilated other genres and tested the limits of its own generic definition, its history has been punctuated by exceptional texts that seem to rewrite the genre and engage in many-voiced relations to earlier novels and to other signifying practices, from the everyday or journalistic to the philosophical or religious. In fact, the most telling question posed by the novel to historiography may be whether contemporary historical writing can learn something of a self-critical nature from a mode of discourse it has often tried to use or to explain in overly reductive fashion. A different way of reading novels may alert us not only to the contestatory voices and counter-discourses of the past, but to the ways in which historiography itself may conceivably become a more critical voice in the human sciences. I'd like to conclude by turning very briefly to a broad issue that's implicit in my talk and that is much debated at present, the role of a canon in the selection of significant texts. After all, I've been talking about significant texts, and for the most part, this is related to the notion of a canon. Both feminist and Marxist criticism have brought out the intellectual and socio-political tendentiousness of the idea that there is a single canon of texts or artifacts, notably one made up of an exclusive list of high cultural items, such as great novels. But the critique of a canon has an obvious and forceful bearing on intellectual history that I wouldn't deny. Intellectual history has often focused on the artifacts of high culture, or in even more circumscribed fashion, on abstracted ideas or structures of consciousness, in splendid isolation from other levels of culture and from socio-political problems. And this was one of the justifiable bases for the revolt of social historians against intellectual history. I would, however, question the quasi-ritualistic belief that a text is hopelessly contaminated by its function in a canon, and that the alternative strategy should be to focus more or less exclusively on more, quote, representative artifacts, such as items of popular culture that have traditionally been omitted from the canon of elite monuments. I'd argue that this kind of professional populism often functions as a methodological way of making a scapegoat of high culture or its bearers. And at least in historiography, it engenders the vicious paradox by which a certain class of scholars, notably social historians, attempt to establish their own disciplinary prominence or even hegemony through a vicarious appeal to the oppressed of the past. And I think that in historiography and perhaps elsewhere at the present time, one has an important nexus linking sociocentric interpretation, professional populism, often with no political implications, professional populism, methodological scapegoating, and disciplinary hegemony. The larger setting in which the questions raised by a canon should, I think, be situated is that of the actual and desirable relations between popular and high culture, relations complicated in the modern period by the impact of so-called commodified culture. The effects of a commodity system upon culture are mystified as much by a fixation on a formalistic or purely hermeneutic appropriation of elite monuments as by a puristic missionary zeal or bright-eyed boosterism in advocating the study of popular culture, in the manner of Robert Darnton, for example. The obvious problem is how to relate a non-canonical or contestatory reading of high cultural artifacts such as, quote, great novels, and the investigation of artifacts such as, quote, popular novels that have traditionally been excluded from canons. I'd suggest that students of culture, especially in the highly commodified modern period, have fewer chances of being critical and self-critical if they haven't developed certain abilities in an exchange with cultural artifacts that themselves have particularly critical or even transformative relations to commodified culture. These artifacts may be found in both popular and high culture, although there are very serious problems in trying to connect high and popular culture in the modern period. Yet the crucial problem may not be whether a given artifact is part of an established canon. Anti-canonical approaches are, after all, in the process of establishing their own canons. The question may be instead whether an artifact has been subjected to canonical interpretations and uses that are open to question. Here the point may not be simply to reject a Bildungsideal, it may be to give it a new shape by bringing it into contact with intellectual and sociopolitical issues from which it has often served as a refuge. And I'd stop there and simply indicate that my incentive in this lecture has been to try to defend in general terms hybrid forms that are often not entirely unified, and especially the form of history and criticism, which I think has relatively little place in contemporary historiography.
For Dominic to respond to.
Preferably,
yes.
Monologues.
Yeah. Dominic, you are bent on rearranging the boundaries between disciplines and opening both historiography and literary criticism to allow them to transgress. But in isolating your polemic and engaging in the polemic, even though you define the novel as hybrid, you seem to accept, at least for the sake of the polemic, a fairly isolated and perhaps even reified notion of the novel, or of novel, even in a very broad Bohemian sense. So I wonder if you would engage in contesting your own sort of isolation of the novel as this. I mean, you alluded, for example, it sounded like you were promising to say a bit about historical novel or ethnographic novel, or Manithian satire as something which is perhaps itself more than hybrid.
What do you think we pay you for? No, I think the notion of hybrid is misleading, because the hybrid biologically is something that always takes. That's to say, it's a form that is a product of reproduction. And I think the risk that any experimental form of writing has to take, including the novel, is that the attempt to bring things together may not reproduce. And that, I think, is a risk that has to be incurred. And I think it's also a risk that is actively sought out in certain forms of writing, including certain forms of novel. And it's in that sense that the hybrid can be a misleading metaphor, especially in its biological connotation. And I think it's true that in terms of the Menippean satire, you have in the literature two concepts of the Menippean satire, that of Northrop Frye, which tends to see the Menippean satire as, in a way, one more category for classifying novels. And the other notion of the Menippean satire is that of Bakhtin, where the Menippean satire always at least threatens to burst its own defining categories, so that it's a name which may not be functioning as a name anymore. And that is, in some sense, the more controversial and in many ways critical concept of the Menippean satire. And it, in a sense, it impairs the use of the Menippean satire as a formal classifying device. And I think the interesting question is, I think you can certainly point to a number of novels, not simply in the modern period. That's why this notion of periodicity, although again that's misleading because it implies a kind of regularity, that some notion of problematic periodicity is more valuable than periodization, because you certainly have this happening in Don Quixote, you have it happening in Sterne, and you have it happening in quote-unquote very early novels, as well as in novels after Flaubert. That's why the use of these periodizing terms can often be very misleading. But I don't know if you had something more in mind.
No, that's it. It sounded more like Frye when you were invoking these things, but I would have assumed that you were on your way, or you have been on your way to the more radical notion of the Athenian times. And I thought perhaps this could be explained from the, or by the fact that you're isolating your polemic. So you're isolating your polemic a moment, that you said at the beginning, so you have to use
Well, again, here one's estimation of audience is, I think, very important. I tend to believe, perhaps unfairly, that at the present time in historiography, new criticism would be revolutionary. Now, that may be unfair.
Richard.
I want to pursue the question of the hybrid of that metaphor. It seems to me that the risk that you run by using that metaphor is to fail to sort of think the extent to which the two terms, the two poles that you set up, are not so easily reconciled. Indeed, that they may involve some inherent conflictual relationship. I mean, on the one hand, you seem to agree that there can be no good history which doesn't pay its respect to the documentary and to the factual. Just as there can be no good literature which doesn't allow at one moment some formalization, some formal description. But if you think, for example, of say Lukács's notion that Paul the Man approves of so strongly in Blindness and Insight, of the novel as fundamentally ironic, the notion of irony that's working there, as de Mol points out, is neither strictly a formal principle nor some kind of content or substance. It is, he says, a way of thinking about the novel such that the novel no longer is considered in any way as representational of reality, but of demonstrating a fundamental impossibility. That its fictionality consists precisely to the extent to which it demonstrates and describes the distance between what Lukács calls Wesen und Leben, between a certain transcendental ideal, a certain dream of totality, for example, on the one hand, of a certain, say, formalistic ambition, as it might represent itself on the one hand, and a certain factual or documentary realism on the other. And it's precisely the specificity of the novel is precisely that demonstration of the incompatibleness, the impossibility of any hybrid, for example, between those two visions. That the novel is the epic of a world from which the gods are absent names precisely the impossibility of anything like a facile hybrid of those two poles.
Well, what I would begin by saying is that when you invoke Lukácsian notion of the novel as in quest of a kind of formal totality, that again is a certain form of novel. And insofar as one is arguing that the attempt to bring together a documentary incentive and some form of critical incentive, which may be understood in terms of a mode of totalization or may already be understood in terms of a mode of self-questioning, if not self-subversion. When one brings those two together, I think that one can apply that account to history as well as to the novel. I don't see it as designating the specificity of the novel. That's why what I was trying to indicate was that the one level in which I would see something of a distinction is on the level of the invention of events. On a more structural level, I'm not sure the extent to which the distinctions hold up. Now, if one is arguing against the notion of a hybrid as facile, then I think one would have to argue against that notion in historiography as in relation to the novel, not as designating the specificity of the novel. And I think that in a certain way, I would argue that the notion of the hybrid, insofar as it's not reified, and insofar as it's open to the possibility of unrecognizable forms, which is to say monstrosities, which are more in the direction of what you are talking about, that then it remains a useful notion, at least critically, when you're trying to address a certain discipline in which the idea of order or the idea of knowledge as imposing order on chaos is light years away from the hybrid, and I think would be totally unaccepting to anything more extreme, right? But that doesn't, of course, answer the substantive issue. That's, again, a question of audience. But what I would say in response to your question is that if your argument is accurate, I think it applies to history as well as to the novel, and it doesn't designate the specificity of the novel.
Dominic, I think the larger question you raise is the relationship between fact and fiction. I'm simply curious as to your particular notion of what the end of historical research is, because you seem to emphasize the dialogue between kind of present and past and sort of self-critical end. And if I understand critical theory, the ultimate aim is to change society through self-recognition. It seems to me that the critical historical research is trying to reconstruct what has been lost, voices which have never spoken. The actual process of changing the present seems to be a different task. So I'm just curious as to whether what you see as the difference between fiction and fact.
Well, I don't. Well, let me begin by saying that I see the reconstruction of the past as one element of historiography. I do not see it first as the sole task of historiography, and I do not even see it as the dominant task of historiography. I think that the reconstruction of the past has to be related in this tense fashion to some kind of an exchange with the past, which does have implications in the present. And I think that this notion is very much out of favor at present. It's in a way a resuscitation of a more Renaissance idea of historiography in terms of the nature of historical understanding and its ethical political function. And along with that, the idea that the notion of the recovery of the voices of the past easily gives itself to an aimless positivism unless it's connected with some other kind of incentive. And I think that at least for certain people who are trying to resuscitate or at least to give some form of representation to certain voices of the past, oppressed voices of the past, that the incentive in doing that is not simply to map better society in the past, but to indicate modes of resistance that may conceivably have some kind of implication for present activities. And that is not a universal incentive, obviously, but I think that is one important incentive in this kind of research. And here you're talking about voices in the sense of simply voices that have not been represented in historical narratives. Along with this, I think that this entire problem of transference is very important, because I think that very often what happens in this kind of research is an almost uncontrolled process of identification, which I think is one of the more fascinating and more disconcerting aspects of Ginsberg's book, where there's an almost unity of voice between the historical narrator and the figure that he is trying to reconstruct on the basis of very fragmentary evidence. And so the historian becomes a kind of ventriloquating voice, and the voice that's recreated in the past is in good part a projective voice. And I'm not sure you can avoid that, but I think it's something that certainly bears more underlining than it's been given in history.
You itemized a number of voices that are available to the historian, that is antipathy, sympathy, show and tell, and transcendental irony. and indicated that that was a very limited repertoire. And I wondered if you saw any other species of voice that has been developed within the context of literary criticism. And if so, that might provide, as well as the novel itself, another area of fertile research for that historical voice.
Yeah. Well, I think what you could argue that one thing that's happened, one obvious thing that everybody says, of course, has happened in contemporary criticism is that the massive division between literature and literary criticism has tended to break down, and there is more of a relationship of exchange between the two. And I think that what you can say that's also happened as well is that one of the things in the novel, in terms of modulation of voice, was certainly so-called free indirect style, where you had very subtle variations in proximity and distance, empathy and irony, in relation to the object of discourse. And I think that this is one of the things that has certainly also arisen in literary criticism. And one of the difficulties in certain of the variations of free indirect style is that it may very often undermine a sense of the documentary, or what you can attribute to the object. And that's one of the difficulties with it stylistically in historiography. But in terms of more subtle modulations in the relationship between the narrative quote-unquote voice or writer and the object of discourse, that I think is somewhat different. I mean,
I think that was just a comment.
Yes, Kira.
Continuing what Richard was saying, namely that in the novel, the representation, the story, can be seen and read as the allegory of its own textual composition, of the tenets of its textual composition. I wonder whether the same analysis could be done for an historical narrative, and if you did try to do the same kind of analysis.
Well, I think this is a question, I'm not sure it's the same question. I think it's a question that goes in a way in a more formalistic direction. That's to say that you can read a novel in terms of a creation of its own world, detaching it from any kind of relationship to other discourses in society, to other phenomena in society. And I think you can certainly do that, but what I was saying indicates that I think that there are important limitations to doing that, because one of the problems it takes you away from is this precisely this tension between the attempt to incorporate quasi-documentary features and the attempt to generate some kind of formalistic structure. That really doesn't become a problem insofar as you simply see the novel as constituting a world of fictionality, or in terms of Easer and kind of neo-Husserlian analysis as elaborating a structure of fictionality. So the thing I was trying to argue was that the tensions between incorporating documentary references and elaborating a narrative or rhetorical structure appear with significant differentiations in history and the novel. Again, the norm in history, and this is an important thing, I think this is one thing that probably all historians are committed to, that the historian cannot invent facts. The historian, for example, cannot argue that Robespierre could not conceivably have been guillotined because it was not plausible in terms of the evolution or the movement of the revolution at that time. That's something that the historian presumably cannot argue. Nor by the same token can someone analyzing the red and the black argue that on the basis of a discovery of a certain document in Besançon, they have conclusive proof that Julien Sorel was not really beheaded, that it was someone else in disguise. But as I said, that once that breaks down, you have either myth or very interesting forms of pathology, or very fascinating forms of pathology that arise. But what I was trying to do was to set up more of a notion of interference, perhaps in terms of the inadequate notion of hybrid, more of a notion of interference between what happens in the novel and what happens in historiography. And that's, in certain ways, comparable problems tend to arise.
Within the limits of your focus, which are determined by those positions you're polemicizing against those institutional contexts which separate by disciplines and so on, I agree with almost everything you have said. My question is perhaps directed at what you didn't say, but I'm not even sure where it would go if you were to elaborate in terms that you suggested to us. The question is about this. I agreed from the beginning when you said that the notion of the social as simply the context for a text, the inert background for a text, is inadequate. Positivist, and we need to develop a post-positivist notion of the way a text relates to its context. The model you come up with is either the transferential or the dialogic as the interpretation of the relation between the text and the context. My question is the text and the context, us and history, do we exist on the same homogeneous space? Because there is a possibility that a dialogism can be conceived as ultimately a cuckoo, as ultimately something which exists as a dialogue between two elements that exist in the same space. This is fundamentally a question that somebody like Derrida would raise in the context of signature and context. What is context if we don't have recourse to one homogeneous space, to the closure that would suggest one homogeneous space. Now, your notion of dialogism, developed as it is from Bakhtin, and I think it's significantly different in some ways, doesn't quite tell me enough to determine whether the dialogism between the text and the context, interpreter and history, is ultimately recuperable in one space, or if it suggests or can accommodate the notion of a fundamental absence, something that will always be there. I think it ties in some ways with the notion of hybrid. Can it ultimately be recuperated? Can it ultimately all exist together? Is it coexistence you're talking about, or some form of radical therapy which we don't yet know what to do with?
Yeah, I think that the problem of difference, which in some sense is not only necessary to exchange an interpretation, but also an impediment to change an interpretation, is very, very important. The only thing that I would ask is whether or not the role of difference in that sense, or the force of something that cannot be entirely interpreted within an historical frame of reference, whether that applies to the relationship between past or present and present, or also applies in the putative present. In other words, I don't really see any significant difference between historical understanding in that respect and contemporary understanding. I think one of the things that happens in historiography is that when there's a great deal of emphasis placed upon the wonderful strangeness and difference of the past, in historiography, this easily lends itself to a kind of exotic romanticism. And the thing it obscures is that for most people today, a text of Derrida is more strange than the mentality of the peasantry in the old regime. So I think, I would agree that the problem of difference is crucial, but that it's not distinctive to conventional historical understanding.
Yeah. I mean, the question is not just about the finitude that we are. The question is not just about the finiteness of our knowledge. The question is how that finiteness is conceived. Is it conceived? I mean, Gadamer would also posit finitude, but it's ultimately a recuperable one. There is the ideal. It all exists in one homogeneous, continuous space. And that continuism is the one that I think poses the greatest challenge then to the writing of history or the novel that takes from history. As a continuous discourse between us and the social. So there's a mapping going on there, but what status does that mapping have in relation to narrativity, in relation to knowledge, and all of that?
Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the great anxieties in interpretation is the anxiety that one may not understand. And I think that's a necessary anxiety, that there may not be a fusion of horizons.
Yes, and a determined one, though. I mean, that anxiety is not something which is an absolute one, but a specific one. That's the difference, I guess, between seeing it as an absolute gesture and one that is a textual one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, to get back to the institutional implications, I mean, one of the things that is true is that history has been incredibly successful in employing its own techniques and procedures of investigation. That it is true now that history can proceed on the basis of tacit knowledge, that individuals can study with people and emulate certain texts and produce things that are very, very good. And by contrast, in departments of literature, including now departments of English that have more or less become infiltrated by a number of different discourses, it's more difficult to determine what counts as good criticism and what doesn't count as good criticism. And I think that the resistance to certain modes of interpretation and certain modes of debate is to a great extent provoked by a desire to exclude certain kinds of controversy. And in terms of institutional functioning, this has, I think, very equivocal status. On the one hand, I would argue against it. On the other hand, I would have to say that one of the nice things about history departments is that insofar as people in them doing a certain kind of research remain very self-confident about what they're doing, they in no sense feel threatened by other kinds of research. Whereas in contrast, in literature departments, if there is the smallest marginal differentiation in a tendency, it immediately becomes almost paranoid in its implications.
There is wine and cheese up the hill in the White House. I like it.